This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we'll hear a conversation between Ali Metters Knight of the Machupta Indian Tribe and NSPR's Matt Fidler about the interconnectivity of racial injustice, colonization, and wildfire. If you have questions for us, let us know on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. For Friday, June 19th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. There are a lot of issues facing Chico and the rest of the North State right now. The pandemic, racial injustice, police reform, a rising homeless population, drug abuse, poverty, and of course, wildfires, which are becoming more deadly. While we often focus on all of these issues separately, member of the Machupta Indian Tribe, Ali Metters Knight, says all of these issues are related. She recently spoke with NSPR's Matt Fidler about the interconnectivity of all of them.
So I'm a member of the Machupta Indian tribe. My father is Machupta. His mother is Machupta. And both of her parents are, one's from Covelo and one is from Chico for Chico, and then the other from Machupta. So we have Nomalaki, Kankau, Wintun, and Machupta as the tribal lineals that I have just from my grandmother.
So for people who might not know, where are those ancestral lands?
So Machupta is here in Chico. So the city of Chico up to Paradise encompasses the Machupta territory. So we kind of calculate that territory based on the Peace and Friendship Treaty that was signed around 1851, 1852 here in Chico, California with John Bidwell. Nomalaki is mostly in the Pascanta area. So when you're looking at Corning, then you're going out to Pascanta. That's Nomalaki. Kankau is more in the Oroville area. So Berry Creek, up in those mountains, maybe even actually what we call Kankau today, between Paradise and Oroville. And then we also have Wintu, which is closer to the river, a Sacramento River near Durham, next to the Putwins. Across the river would be the Pomos. So Wintu would be in that area of the Sacramento River, more like Orland.
Can you tell me a little bit about Native American population out here's perspective of your relationship with the police, like with local police, Butte, you know, local Chico police, sheriff's offices, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so Chico, California, I came out here in 1993. And so I graduated high school in Virginia, came out to this area. And what I first started noticing was that the Chico police here where we're pretty much on gang task force 24/7. So anybody who looked like they could be gang affiliated were highly harassed by the police. And I noticed that my uncles, my dad, my cousins, they would get pulled over a lot, be put on the side of the road, hands in the air, just a lot of drama, a lot of searching. And these are folks with no records, no felonies, anything. It was just based on the color of their skin. And our family would have these stories. We talk about it being profiled as gang members. It really kind of surfaced a lot when Chico PD was actually kind of indifferent about the crimes against natives. We had a young man who was hit by a car out here in Chico, and the car spun around to hit him over again. And a neighbor came to help. And the Chico PD, when they came to the scene, just threw a blanket over him and pretty much didn't charge anybody for a crime, because this was a local native folks. And the police here have just had a very indifferent, if not hostile, feelings about natives. The PD has changed, but I don't think they've ever reconciled the truth of how they've treated local natives throughout the years here.
How would you like to see your relationship improve? Like, do you have a vision for what a good step in the right direction would look like?
Yeah, I really do. I think that defunding the police, there is defundchicopd.org is a website that we've put together. I think that putting the services outside of just the police department and creating other community development services that adequately serve people in this community especially have the education of our existence has to be reestablished. And I think it starts with social workers, police officers, judges, and political representatives. So I think that what I'd like to see is more money funneled through the Chico community for development, educational outreach. That's what I see is, and basically a less presence of police officers as the social, I guess we'd call mediators that we've been relying on, that they're just not capable of the job.
Is it kind of a refunding of it and going to different resources? I mean, I assume that eventually the idea is to bring back it. I mean, because, you know, violent crime and you know, crime does happen. We probably do need police officers for that kind of thing, but less confrontation by the police for maybe other kind of social ills that are not violent. Is that what you're suggesting?
Right, right. I mean, you could look at statistically, police don't usually show up and save the day on a crime and kill the bad guy. We actually pay a lot of movie in our cable bills to see that in real life because it really doesn't happen. We pay a lot of money to see that. They tend to come after a crime. They do reporting. They're focused mostly on investigation for justice and acquiring people that have gotten away with crime and looking at, you know, they're more investigative. They should be more investigators and less patrol and basically overseers of the community wearing guns and going in on domestic disputes or going in on situations that are very hostile and volatile, having very little crisis management training, very little de-escalation training, and then being completely irresponsible with the position they have. And so I think that defunding is about looking at what they're capable of doing, which is investigating, learning, understanding. But we should be putting a lot of these services that we have for domestic violence, for even youth, when we have police officers in high schools that are equipped with guns. They're there to de-escalate a situation with a child. They're there to kill the child. And so we have to understand the position that we've put these police officers in ourselves and then remove that and change the whole dynamic of how we basically police our community, but basically also how we maintain the health of our community. We can't maintain health with guns and hostile, overzealous police that are just looking for bad guys to kill.
It was, I think, 2 Wednesdays ago, or about almost 3 weeks ago now, where you spoke at a rally that was after the rally that was canceled because of threats. And then there was one, I believe, the next day. And can you tell me the story about how that rally started and how you opened up your speech?
Yes. So I work with this group called Justice for Desmond. Desmond Phillips was shot by police officers here in Chico in 2017 in his apartment. His dad called for help for a mental crisis. And Chico PD pushed down the door within the seconds, tased and shot him dead in front of his father. So Justice for Desmond is a group that I speak for. They were invited to speak on Tuesday. It was canceled for me to open up and speak because of threats, online threats, rumored to have people come and counter protest that were going to be hostile and maybe aggressive, if not violent. So I went Wednesday instead, and there was about 200 people downtown Chico. And I brought a microphone and an amplifier and turned it up and started off, "Welcome to occupied Machupta territory." And I got everyone's attention. No justice, no peace, no racist police. And then we go into Chico and our budget. And Chico's tax budget, based on our population, we put over 50% of our whole tax budget every year into the police department. And that has grown and grown and grown. And so I started talking about the gun range, that the police officers have a private gun range, that they have a $900 allowance, uniform allowance that they can spend at their own gun range, and that this is on the taxpayer's back and it's not procured. It's not inventoried.
How was the crowd that night? Was there any, I haven't seen any vandalism in Chico with these rallies. Did you see anything like that?
No, no. In fact, there was a little bit of people that wanted to get a little bit rowdy and kind of march downtown. We'd already seen businesses board up, you know, and I had gone in front and I said, "Look, we don't have millionaire corporate America down in our downtown. Those are our neighbors. Those are our friends. These are not millionaires. We are not going to be busting up their businesses. This is their livelihood. We're here to make a change. And so I basically invited everybody on a movement. And, you know, the movement is not just about police reform. The movement is about decolonization. And then I broke it down to them what I was willing to do.
You're listening to Special Coverage from North State Public Radio. When we're back, we'll learn what Allie Metters Knight decided she was going to do to help her community to start heal wounds she says were created by colonization. Stay tuned.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from DuckDuckGo, a privacy company committed to raising the standard of trust online. Used by millions, they work to help people search privately and void trackers. DuckDuckGo. Privacy simplified. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting those working towards a day when no one has to choose between paying rent, putting food on the table, and protecting their health and the health of others. RWJF.org. And from Americans for the Arts. Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting those working towards a day when no one has to choose between paying rent, putting food on the table, and protecting their health and the health of others. RWJF.org. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for small businesses with an automated virtual receptionist and mobility features to run businesses from anywhere. More at ooma.com. And from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Learn more at raymondjames.com.
This is Special Coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Before the break, Allie Metters Knight, member of the Machupta Indian tribe, whose ancestors lived in the area now known as Chico for thousands of years, was talking about the need for decolonization to heal our society and land. She says to do this, we all need to learn about something called TEK.
TEK is traditional ecological knowledge. So traditional ecological knowledge is based on indigenous knowledge of a place. So as science is about what scientists have observed in this area, and we can even look at European Western science have been here for about 450 years, TEK is traditional ecological knowledge. That's 10,000 years of science based on indigenous observation, trials, and tribulations, and learning about the plants, ecosystem, animals, and how it all works. So some of that knowledge has been passed down through words, some of it has been passed down through technologies like basket weaving, and some of this knowledge has been passed down through hunting and just skills that are part of ceremonial lives of men and women as they grow up. These ceremonies aren't so strong in strongly colonized areas, but there are areas in California that have this native life and this indigenous life still thriving.
So how can you use traditional ecological knowledge to help with a lot of the issues that we're dealing with, from overly aggressive police sometimes to poor management of land, you know, wildfires? How can you make that connection between it? Because I think sometimes we tend to think that all these problems are isolated.
Yeah. I always look at like a marriage. There's a marriage. The marriage is between racism, colonialism, and capitalism. And these three married together create the nation of America, the United States of America. And so this United States was based on proving that on racism, that whites, which was made up out of thin air, there was no white race up until the United States was born. And so they went and said, look, this white race is superior, and we're going to show you through capitalism and colonization. And colonization is a very ugly human tool of taking not over humans, political, you know, indigenous people's political power over their land, but also to actually destroy every bit of the culture in order to assimilate them into a new one. And so in that way, colonization is a cancer to a human society because it acts like cancer in a human body. And it colonizes like cancer in a human body. And everything toxic and disgusting and sad that can come out of cancer can come out of colonization.
Some people might observe that we have all these fun toys and luxuries and conveniences and vaccines against diseases and all this stuff that came out of the, you know, colonization culture. Do you want that stuff to go away? Or, I mean, like... Yeah, can you just address that?
Well, it's not sustainable. See, when you have a nation that's based on one, the premise that one race is superior than the other, which is false, which is going to be played out and shown to be not true, because this is the nature of the universe. Lies don't last forever. And second, you know, you have the idea of capitalism. That's not sustainable. That's all extraction and product. And then trade, not trade locally, which is the true word of economy, but trade out around the world, global economy. So, and then you have colonization, which is basically taking over land, privatizing it. But pretty soon, how are you going to privatize everything? You know, how it's like a room that you've given space for, you know, you become a hoarder. There's no space for anybody. Everything is possessed, it's owned. It's only traded back and forth between people of wealth. Everybody of poor has got to fend for themselves and live off the land in a very odd way. This is not a great way. This is not a very ingenious method of sustainable life. This is very primitive. And so this primitive way of life that the United States has set up has convinced and programmed everyone to think that they're living high off the hog. It's not far to believe that we have been raised in a society that has made us delusional. And so when we look at changing society, it will go away on its own. It's not going to sustain itself. So you have to have backup plan. You have to have a plan B. And a plan B is about how do you take something that's falling apart and let it morph into something else that's a lot more comfortable for everybody. And so that's the idea of decolonization. To take land, to teach people how to do traditional ecological knowledge, how to manage the land. First, you're going to have to do a lot of fixing the land. So you have to do a lot of recovery of native plants and a lot of restoration projects to do to watersheds. Then after you fix it, then you have to maintain it. Those are jobs forever. But after you maintain the land, you should have rights to the land. So I think that that's a redistribution of wealth through land, using land management. And I think that's a great social justice movement to look forward to.
Can you talk about how you kind of started doing this?
Yeah, so I started working with my tribe, the Machupta Indian tribe. And I went to them and I said, look, we can't do driver's licenses. We can't do hair cutting licenses. Shoot, we can't even do sawyer licenses to cut down trees. You know, all these things are licensed by the state of California. But what we can do is we can license people to do TEK, traditional ecological knowledge, land management certification. Well, they learn and have certification on plants, their uses, how to restore, how to take care, and then how to maintain land using TEK and having certifications. And I started realizing that, you know, the tribe was kind of needing some more education. So we did kind of like a town hall and invited not only Machupta tribal members, but community tribal members in Chico to come and learn about TEK and the certification project. So we did basically a trial run on 5 plants, like a first phase 1, step 1 of TEK certification. And we have about 100 people certified in the community. It was a lot of work. We did a lot of training. And then after we did training, we actually came back in and did certification tests. So after I trained everybody, I test them. So it's about...
So you're testing the traditional knowledge?
The knowledge, yeah. So for example, we have mugwort is munmuni. So we go into the riparia zone, we look at munmuni, and then it's medicinal uses. We don't really go through the medicinal uses as more of we do at its complement and its role in the ecosystem in a riparia. And then we look about the plants that it grows around and what conditions and soil that it does. And then how well, and then spread seeds out. And it's competitive with star thistle. So if you want to compete Star Thistle, you could use mugwort. And so we are using these ideas and what they do to kind of clean up watersheds. So they kind of spend the whole day. We go over Moonmuni, other places it grows, the smell, the taste, the texture, how it grows, different stages of it. Then we usually start learning the tribal words and names so that we can talk in the language. I'm always explaining to them that I deeply feel that the land remembers the language that was spoken for here so long, and that connection and using just a few words and calling the name, the plants by their name, by their natives' names here, is an act of solidarity and decolonization for the native folks here and to the community and ecosystem itself.
So I think about some of the issues that are, you know, seem like they're the most important right here in, you know, the Chico area and the North State in general. Homelessness, poverty, land management fires, of course, police abuse, domestic abuse. Do you think learning TEK and developing, can this help with those issues as well? Or is that a little too far of a reach?
No, I think that it's a transition for people to get a way out. I think a lot of times people are trapped in their life and they can't get any way out. People feel the oppression. They articulate that they're stuck in their rent. They're stuck with their mortgage. They're stuck in their life. And they really can't make enough money to get to the places that they want to be and have the experiences they want. And some people do, and they're really comfortable. But there are folks that really want to have a break. And so I think having a program where we're saying, let's go take this federal land, this public land, let's all get certified, let's get jobs managing it, and then let's go ahead and start making this our new home. And we start creating new communities based on new programming. And I think this new programming of looking at land management as the genesis of our basically each one teach one and our many hands make light work projects for the day. You know, I think that changes the dynamics of who survives and who doesn't survive in the future. And people that survive are people that can work together with others, cooperate, and shared experiences, and share land.
I know that, you know, the media has traditionally not done a very good job of, you know, giving a voice to Native communities around the country. What can we do better at NSPR? What would you like the media to get right that maybe it hasn't in the past?
Well, I think that if we look at for Native communities, what we are taught in school is basically maybe some archaeology, some anthropology, and it's always past. And about the history of Native people and the past. And I'm a history buff. I love history books. I'll read, you know, nonfiction for days trying to figure out what I can do to restore the history in the future here. And so what I find is that it is about today's stories. It's about TEK. It's about the sovereignty of a nation. A lot of people don't realize that I'm not a race. I am a citizen of a sovereign nation that has been here for thousands of years. It's almost like going over to when you go to Afghanistan and they have a new regime or a new government and you find tribal people that have been there for thousands of years. Is that reverence, is that they do exist. Yes, there are policies and sanctions and things that are here now, but it never is supposed to, it's supposed to be an acculturation of communities, not an assimilation. We're not supposed to be erased. So the media, I feel, has a really great opportunity to help reestablish the existence of sovereign nation and the citizenship that natives have, and the access to the citizenship can actually empower other people.
That was Ali Metters Knight, member of the Machupta Indian tribe, speaking with NSPR's Matt Fidler. And that is your program. But before we head out, we're going to hear a little bit from you. We've been asking how you feel about reopening during this pandemic. Here's what many of you had to say.
I'm scared to death. I think it's too early to open up. We don't have a cure. It's a peculiar virus. It's unpredictable.
It amazes me that the government has taken so much control over this whole situation.
I am very concerned about the loosening of restrictions in Butte County, and I think that it's a real mistake.
I'm very much comfortable with them opening up. I think they should have opened up much sooner. I've talked to 5 doctors up here in this vacation area where we're at, and they've all said that the only thing we know for sure is that we are not being told the truth.
I think we're going too fast, but then again, I'm a 70-year-old retired person, and my income isn't dependent on how fast we're going, so I may have a different perspective than a lot of people.
I'm very concerned. I think we are having a false sense of security, and I'm already seeing people not wearing masks, and it's very, very concerning to me. Any of us could be carrying it and not know it and expose others who might be highly at risk. Well, so I hope everyone will continue to be careful.
I am concerned, not that we are loosening restrictions, but that people's reaction to the loosening restrictions. Anyone that's ever taken antibiotics will know these words, take until completed. And it seems like overnight, everyone decided not to wear masks anymore. We are not through this yet. So Butte County is the first to loosen the restrictions, but we're going to be the first to be placed back on them if we continue to not take this seriously.
In my opinion, statistically so low here in the North State, anywhere north of Sacramento, everything should be back open. The statistics are just so low here in comparison to metro areas.
I'm not as concerned about the speed of which the country is opening up. I'm concerned about the apathy and lack of concern that my fellow citizens have. Even in this little town that was burned down from a campfire, very few people up here wear masks. Very few people do social distancing. People who are buying into President Trump's view that this isn't a big deal is very concerning, and it shouldn't be a political issue, but it has become a political issue. And I've been in stores up in Paradise, and I've had people make fun of me because I wear a mask and because I do social distance. I think the problem is that we could open up if people were social distancing and people were wearing masks and people were being responsible. Why is our country so apathetic?
That was some of your thoughts on reopening during this pandemic. If you have more or any others, leave them on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, Angel Haracha, Eric Radaviel, Kylo Castilla, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, News Director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30 or catch the rebroadcast the following weekday morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned to North State Public Radio.